This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Something a little different for you today. We'll talk to an expert forager about taking advantage of what Mother Nature provides without you having to plant it. Sam Thayer is back with us. He's an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. He's been teaching classes and workshops around the United States for about 3 decades. His award-winning foraging books include Sam Thayer's Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants of Eastern and Central North America. Hi there, Sam.
Hi, Jill.
So, Sam, I was wondering, how did you acquire your knowledge about foraging? When did that start?
Well, you know, when I was a little kid, I just remembered anything about free food. And so, foraging wasn't that kind of as a name for the topic. That didn't really exist so much when I was a kid, but we had a black walnut tree 2 houses down from us, and my dad showed me that I could eat the black walnuts. And then my grandmother and my grandfather, they had 2 black walnut trees in their yard. So that's one of the first things I learned. And there was a butternut tree across the road in someone else's yard, and I got permission to pick those, and my parents showed me those. So, but I just never forgot those things, and I just built on it. And I was just fascinated. So it was largely self-taught, but I picked it up from people here and there until I was 10. And I discovered this little booklet, Bradford Angier's Guide to How to Live in the Woods. And that had about 40 wild edible plants in it. And I was like, my mind was blown. I was like, wow, this stuff is in a book. And then I started realizing there was other books about it. So I certainly had people I learned from in my childhood. But it was mostly self-taught through books, and I just slowly accumulated it. And I was obsessed. You know, some kids are obsessed with trains, and I was obsessed with, birds and reptiles and amphibians and plants that I could eat especially.
Not the birds and amphibians that you could eat, just the plants?
You can eat some birds and amphibians, right. But I was interested in them because I just was fascinated. I'm still an avid bird watcher,
sure.
And still an avid amphibian watcher and reptile watcher, but the one that ended up being my career, I guess, and the central focus of my life was foraging for plants.
Yeah, because it really has, hasn't it? Now, did you go to school advanced education for this?
I did not. Okay. I mean, I studied botany so earnestly, mm-hmm. as a teenager, but when it came time, I had this dream. I was going to go live off the land, and I worked through high school and saved up money. And so when I was 18, I bought 60 acres, an abandoned dairy farm, and built a little cabin on it. And that was my dream. And I thought, I'll do anything for work to support my addiction to foraging. And so I spent, 10 years working, I would say, lower level jobs in the economy and foraging both, and slowly worked into teaching about it as a profession. It was a gradual process.
I love that. That's a wonderful story. How did your parents react to you running around eating weeds and things?
Well, my mom was very against me collecting mushrooms. Other than morels, because that was the one wild mushroom that she knew. My dad was a little bit, just said, well, I just trust him. Just do whatever you want. But as far as the plants go, my mother was more tolerant of that because her mother foraged a little bit in different wild berries, and I didn't realize till I was an adult how much my grandmother knew. She knew a ton about foraging, but I only saw her about once a year, and she didn't share as much with me. She didn't know that I was so interested, ironically. So my mom allowed me to collect lots of plants kind of at will. She trusted me there, but she didn't trust me with mushrooms until I was about 16.
Well, I think she's justified on that mushroom thing. That's very easy to make mistakes with those. So,
It's a little easier with mushrooms than it is with plants to make mistakes. But somebody with a good head on their shoulders is going to be fine in either realm, as long as they're following the same guidelines of you just eat something when you're absolutely certain, mm-hmm. of its edibility status and of its identity, what it is. So mushrooms are slightly trickier, but anyone with a good head on their shoulders can handle mushrooms too.
Okay, great. Well, we have a call already from Sabi in Middleton. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, good morning. I also learned how to look at these plants and figure out which one was edible from my mother, who also taught me how to cook. She's a Palestinian-born American, and I learned from her everything I know about cooking and foraging for things. Porcelain, or purslane, depending on how you read it and pronounce it, is a succulent that is prevalent here in Wisconsin. People eradicate, fight it, and try to kill it. It is a delicious succulent that is relatively undiscovered here in the U.S., and it has a lot of omega-3 fatty acids, and it's really, really good for you if you know how to cook it. So I hope that that was included in your work. And if you know anything about purslane, you know, when I share with the listeners, it's P-U-R-S-L-A-N, I believe. So our dandelions that are eradicated and fought vehemently, my neighbors look at my lawn full of dandelion, and they accuse me of letting the seeds fly everywhere. But if you pluck those in the right time of year, you don't even have to go look for those. They're everywhere. And if you pick them just the right amount and you know how to take the bitterness out and saute them, they make a delicious vegan, vegetarian, or dishes with meat.
Okay. Go ahead,
well,
Sam.
I'm glad that our caller brought up two of my favorite wild edibles. So as far as purslane, that is one of the most widespread native plants in the world. For many years, it was believed that purslane was not native to North America, that it was brought by Europeans. But then archaeologists started finding purslane in archaeological sites and realized, no, this is native here also. So that's a common disturbance-dependent plant and with a fascinating life history. It's that, you know, small plant likes garden soils, disturbed soils, especially where it's sandy with the thick, succulent leaves. And purslane photosynthesizes partly through what they call crassulaic acid metabolism, where it stores, it creates crassulaic acid during the day, and then it converts that to sugar at night, because in doing that, it loses less moisture. So it's a very, it's adapted to high moisture stress, high temperatures and low soil moisture. And it's all over the world. It's native to Australia, Africa, Asia, Europe, in the Americas, and high in iron, and just an incredibly easy plant to work with. So if you look online, you can find tons of recipes for purslane, and it's incredibly easy to identify. So that's a great starter plant for people, because many people have it in their yard, and you don't have to go far to find it generally. Most gardeners are already quite familiar with it. Easy to incorporate into your diet. But it's a hot weather plant. We won't see it appearing in Wisconsin usually until late May, and in some places not till mid-June, because it doesn't like it until it gets at least about 75 degrees out, maybe 80. And dandelion, well, dandelion season is right now.
Yes.
And you know, they're not blooming yet here in northern Wisconsin, but they are in southern Wisconsin. And one thing we do with dandelions is before they bloom, and the flower buds are clustered at the base, right at ground level, and a lot of people don't notice the dandelions at this time, but we'll take a spoon and gouge out this whole cluster of dandelions, and it's like an artichoke. And the thing is, we can return to the same dandelion plants year after year. A lot of people don't realize that a dandelion plant can live for a century. I mean, there's ones we've been gouging out for 15 years.
Wow.
And you gouge out those flower buds, and then we steam them, and just, I mean, they're just this mild artichoke-like vegetable, with artichoke with this faint, you know, lettuce-y bitterness, but it's faint and pleasant. Oh, I mean, I love those dandelion hearts. We call them the gougers. And then shortly after that, we'll harvest the leaves. Now, the key to having dandelion leaves be fantastic as a vegetable, I think there's three key things. One is get them when they're young before the dandelions bloom. And not so much for flavor, but for texture, because when the leaf is still expanding, it's extra tender. The flavor is better, but the texture is much better. The second thing is I don't pick the base of the dandelion leaf. So I use scissors and I cut it. I take the outer two-thirds and I leave the base. So people talk about the bitterness in dandelion leaves, and before you're accustomed to that bitter flavor, It's off-putting to some people, but it's faint in the spring, and the strongest bitterness is in the base of the leaf, so I take the outer part of the leaf. And then the other one is so many traditional dandelion recipes from around the world, fry dandelion, and it could be with olive oil, plant oil, and very often it's with pork. You know, dandelions, onions, and bacon go together. And you know, if you have a healthy source of bacon, that's a really healthy way to cook dandelions. So I love dandelion greens, young ones in the spring, fried with onions and maybe a few other greens. If you've tried them and you didn't like them, but you didn't do it in early spring like that, and you didn't fry them, try them again.
Now, that's key to a lot of the plants you forage, is you have to pick them at the right time.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that we have bred our domestic vegetables to hold themselves in this kind of peak form. So like a head of lettuce, a wild lettuce plant forms a head just like a domestic lettuce head. But the domestic holds that head for like a longer time. The wild lettuce is only in this head form for like 3 to 5 days. And if you don't get it that window, boom, you missed it. But the other side of that coin is the wild lettuce is actually better at that point because it's not artificially kind of bred to hold itself there. So you get a better head of lettuce if you identify wild lettuce at the perfect time. It's better than any romaine. That's specifically our Canada lettuce or Lactuca canadensis, or what in our house we call the good lettuce. that one is better than any romaine you can buy if you hit it just right. So a lot of these wild things, the timing is really, really critical.
Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that you can look up, like in one of your books or other sources. They'll tell you when to pick it, right?
Well, I try to go into detail for all that stuff in my books because mm-hmm. one of the things that frustrated me as a young forager is I would be told, you can eat wild lettuce. Oh, boy, how many times did I have to try it before I found a way that I liked it? And I realized, okay, it's safe anytime. But if I want one of my friends to share it or my mom to be willing to eat a bite, you know, I need to make this good. So I had to figure out what's the right time and also what's the right species. There's actually sometimes it's complicated. We have 6 or 7 wild lettuces in Wisconsin, and 2 of them are very good and 2 are pretty good, and the others are not really very good. So there's stuff to figure out to get the culinarily the best experience.
We're talking with Sam Thayer, an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants.
WPR connects you to people in Wisconsin and around the world. You hear many perspectives and civil conversations every day, and you may even learn a few things along the way. Wisconsin Public Radio brings you thoughtful conversations and the latest news. Thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from the state of Wisconsin, business sponsors, and tens of thousands of supporters who contribute. Thank you to everyone who makes WPR possible on air, on the app, and at WPR.org.
And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Right now we are talking about foraging. Sam, it seems like the interest in foraging has kind of increased quite a bit in the last decade or so. Have you seen that?
It really seems to. And it seemed to start around the Great Recession, 2008, 2009, a strong rekindling of interest in foraging. And then it was got another boost with COVID and all outdoor activities kind of. There was a lot more attention for that summer. Everything outdoors was crowded. But there does seem to have been a steady increase. There's been an increased perception that food is important. You know, we have the slow food movement and organic food movement. And this is kind of part of that, like return to our roots. Like we have enough food now. Let's look for the best food.
No, I love that. I love that. Well, let's go to the phones because we have Nettie in Fond du Lac who has a comment about a couple of wild edibles. Go ahead, Nettie.
Hi, Sam. I am hoping someday to come up and take classes with you, but your story sounds just like mine. I'm 75, though, and I had no way of learning except, on my own. Then I met Grandmother Kiwetinokwe, and a ton from her, especially, the importance of learning to connect with the plants and to listen to them. Are you safe to listen to? But the ones that I would really like to talk about, first of all, is stinging nettles. And there are many varieties of stinging nettles. The ones that are really good to eat are the Urtica dioica. Those are the ones with the great big heart-shaped leaves. And oh my gosh, I can pick them without getting, barehanded, but that's a trick to that. The other ones, the little sword-shaped ones, those are so fibrous that it's really not the best idea to.
Oh, I think we lost her. I'm sorry, Nettie. Maybe you can call back and we can finish up with that. But comments, Sam?
Well, I love you listeners. nettles, again, one of my absolute favorite plants. And one thing that's great about nettles is I have a garden, my wife and I have a garden, and we very much love our garden. But you get some spring things that come up so fast, and, they're just waiting. And stinging nettles are a frost-resistant plant. They can freeze solid, and they're just fine. And, this rich, hearty flavor and this really high-protein green that's extremely digestible, and it just feels so wholesome. It's one of the things I can't wait for in the spring. Stinging nettles, you can make soup out of them. You can saute them. We'll just steam nettles and just sprinkle them with salt and a little butter. And they're just so great and wholesome by themselves. There's a million recipes that you can find online for stinging nettles. And it sounds like Nettie was describing two species of nettle common in Wisconsin that sting, the wood nettle and stinging nettle, both of which are native. The wood nettle is the broader heart-shaped leaf, and I, like Nettie, prefer that one very much. It's more tender than the classic stinging nettle, which is also found in Europe. The wood nettle is only in North America, so we have better nettles in Europe. The stinging nettle, you have to be more careful to get it smaller and younger so that it's more tender. The wood nettle is tender, longer, and at a larger size. But I think they're both excellent.
Okay.
The wood nettle will come up a little later. It's not frost resistant like the stinging nettle.
Okay.
But both of them are ideal in the spring. But you can use the greens later in the growing season. When the plants start flowering, the greens get kind of a gritty texture. And I'll use them for tea at that time, but I'm not going to use them as greens once they have flowers on them.
Okay. Now, the other thing that Nettie wanted to bring up was chickweed. Do you use that?
Oh, yeah. Now, chickweed is excellent. And like nettles, chickweed is a group. So we have at least four or five native chickweeds in Wisconsin, or chickweeds, some of which are native and some of which are not. And every one of them is good. They range from good to also very good. And we have a small native one called stitchwort that has a square stem and paired leaves that is a very cold-resistant native chickweed, and it's perennial. And if you find a carpet of that, I just cut them with scissors. And chickweeds all have a flavor that reminds me of fresh corn silk, like if you took the corn silk and ate it when the corn wasn't quite ripe. And I really like that flavor. Then we have common chickweed, which is mostly in urban areas and gardens, and plant likes cool weather, and you'll see that peaks probably mid-May, great salad plant. All the chickweeds are great salad plants. You can cook them, but they're so dainty, they almost disappear. And then we have one called water chickweed, which is probably the most common chickweed in Wisconsin that foragers collect, and that's the largest of our chickweeds, and it's really common in the driftless area and in most of southern Wisconsin in, slightly sunny forest edges and openings. And that was the one that, when I lived in the Madison area, I collected a lot as a teenager, the water chickweed. So all chickweeds, and I can't teach you to identify them over the phone, but they all have a flower with white petals, five white petals, but each one is split in two, so it looks like 10. So when you see that pattern, there's a very good chance you have a chickweed, and they're a pretty easy group to recognize.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone then. Suzanne in Black Creek, what do you have for us?
Thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering, in regards to the wet lettuce, I'm looking to use it for pain relief, and I was wondering if that's best orally, or can use it orally and topically, and is it just best I could dry it, or do I, you know, make it into a tea right away? Could you explain maybe some of that for me, please?
Okay, so I'm not an expert on the medicinal use of the plant, but I will tell you what I know about this. I do have a friend who has a severe chronic injury that he takes lettuce, wild lettuce, makes his own extract as pain relief. And he uses the prickly wild lettuce, which is one of our non-native lettuces, and it's one of the more strongly flavored ones. He uses that in the midsummer when it's mature. And then he cooks it down and makes some sort of concentrate with it. I can't give you all the details on that. The problem is I eat every day, so I know a lot more about food than medicine, which I don't use nearly as often. but I would say that would be a good starting point, and there's some fairly good instructions online for it. And the lettuces that I find the best for food are the ones that are least used medicinally, which makes sense because the medicinal components tend to be associated with the stronger flavors and the plants at maturity. But that prickly wild lettuce should be easy for you to find almost anywhere in Wisconsin, and it has a prickly base to the leaf, which is very distinct, and a prickly stem. And I won't go further into details that I don't know and mislead you, but that plant, I would say midsummer, and make sure you use preferentially that lettuce as opposed to the other ones.
Okay. Thank you, Susan. We appreciate that call. David Appleton, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. So I'm wondering if you can eat Creeping Charlie or Creeping Jenny, and how about Ramp? It's a type of wild onion. And please, there's two more, hostas and daylilies.
Okay. Well, I'll save the Ramp for last.
Okay.
and I will say Creeping Charlie is edible. It's a mint family plant. It's mostly used as a flavoring, not so much as an ingredient you would use in any significant amount. I think that I scared away a friend in sixth grade by cooking something with way too much Creeping Charlie in it. and so something to be aware of, it is a strong flavor. And it's not my favorite flavor now that I know a lot more foraged flavors. I have a friend in France who adores that plant and uses it a lot in cooking, and has made drinks with it that she has served to me that I thought were excellent, and I would not have conceived of that use of the flavor. So think of that Creeping Charlie as a flavoring plant more than as a food plant, but perfectly safe, and it's a strange mint. Think of it that way. And then hostas. Hostas aren't wild. Hosta young tender greens are edible. I've eaten them a few times. But I don't have hostas in my yard, and so I have not used them extensively. Ellen Zakos is a great foraging author that has a backyard foraging book with a more extensive chapter on using hostas for food, and she's also a great cook, so that might be a place to look there. There's one more he mentioned that I forgot.
Daylilies.
Okay, daylilies are a very controversial wild edible. They're very known. Well, they're very well known as a wild edible. They also make some people have gastric upset or diarrhea. And so there are different varieties and hybrids of daylilies, and some of them are apparently not safe. So I grew up eating daylilies without any problems. But there are people who get sick when they eat daylilies, and this is in my foraging workshops, I do not allow participants to eat daylilies. Because I know eventually somebody will get sick from it. I know other older, more seasoned foraging authors who've told me when I was starting out, don't let people eat daylily in your classes, you know, and I think that was wise. So I eat them with no problem, just the common orange daylily. My favorite part is the flower I'll saute the flowers, and I feed that to my family. We've never had a problem. But I go to the same patches again and again. But any weird-looking daylily that looks anything other than the normal common orange daylily, I would shy away from that, and I would just recognize that some people get ill from daylilies. And finally, he mentioned ramps,
yes,
which is something I was wanted to talk about. So ramps are a native wild onion, and they are very common in Wisconsin. Not everywhere in Wisconsin, but generally statewide, they're common. This is a great wild edible, and I have lots of them on my property, and we eat them on a regular basis. So the name ramps, it comes from there's a European wild onion that's ecologically fairly similar that is called ramson in England. We dropped the second syllable here, but we named our very similar wild onion ramps, also called wild leeks by a lot of people in Wisconsin. And there is a fairly vigorous online debate. This is a controversial wild edible because some people say it's not sustainable to harvest ramps. There are places where people are unsustainably over-harvesting wild ramps from public land. And that needs to stop, and it should not be happening, as with any other over-harvesting. But someone who is a responsible harvester of ramps and follows some basic guidelines, which is, you know, when I harvest a ramp patch, I will take about half of what's there every 4 or 5 years. And I've been harvesting from the same patches for decades, and I watch, right? And how much you can harvest depends on a number of factors, such as what is the competition. I know where I have a lot of trout lily or Pennsylvania sedge with my ramps, for example, two common plants that grow with it. They'll prevent the ramp regeneration. I can't harvest as much in those places, or I'll actually pull out some of my Pennsylvania sedges to allow the ramps to regenerate. So there's a lot to consider there, but it can definitely be done sustainably harvesting. And I guess when I say 50%, I'm harvesting whole plants, bulbs and tops included, which is how ramps are generally traditionally harvested. But you can also harvest just the leaves. When you harvest just the leaves, you prevent the plant from flowering over the long term. If you do it 1 year, you won't. But if you harvest, you know, leaves year after year, but you generally won't eliminate your patch. So I recommend with either one, harvesting leaves or harvesting bulbs, do it judiciously. Don't take all that's there, and keep your eye on your patch where you're harvesting. And also do things to promote your ramps. I will grab some seeds and plant them in a new location that looks like just the right habitat, but there's none there. And I'm positive that I account for many, many times more ramps existing than I have, you know, eaten in my life. So it's something that you can do sustainably. And when you find a good ramp patch, cherish it, because it's just a great early spring vegetable, extremely nutritious, extremely tender. And, you know, it's an oniony green. It's not as strong as chives. And there's some volume there. And so it's really kind of hearty. You can, you know, we will fry ramps and then have them with duck eggs in the morning, for example. And we love that. We make ramp soup. We'll put them in stir fry with lots of different vegetables. I'll put a ramp leaf on a sandwich or a couple ramp leaves. I don't ferment ramps, but I have a friend who does, who gives me a jar every now and then. They're fantastic. There's so many things you can do with it.
Yeah, wild leeks are, well, I grew up calling them wild leeks, but ramps, but they're wonderful. We use them all the time in the spring. So, yeah, what a great, and you do research on them, don't you? I noticed that on your website.
Yeah, so we have, this is the 18th year since I put in my first research plot, and I have an area in my sugar bush where I make maple syrup. It used to be dominated by hemlocks. The hemlocks were cut out. The maples have taken over. And things like ramps and these forest understory plants, they move slowly. So I had a big area that was good ramp habitat with no ramps in it. So I thought, here's a perfect opportunity for me to plant ramps and then monitor their growth rates. And this has kind of ballooned into a whole bunch of different experiments and just observational studies. I need to get these finished and get them published, but I'm like, each year I'm like, wow, new data. So what I found is I put in 85 bulbs. This will be the 18th year. I'm going to have about 3,500 plants from the original 85. So about in 18 years in my first study plot. And what I found is the competition makes a big difference in how fast they reproduce. And what I found is the soil disturbance of harvest really helps the seed germinate. So if you have a good patch and you harvest it, but not over harvest it, it creates ideal opportunities for germination for new seeds. And the harvested patches produce a lot more seeds and flowers than the unharvested patches, because like anything in your garden, you know, if it's too dense, it's not going to thrive and it's not going to produce much fruit. So those are kind of the basic takeaways from the research I've done.
And if you want to check that out, Sam's website is called foragersharvest.com. Lots of info there. And there's a whole page of stuff on ramps. So if you're interested, you can delve deep into that one. So thanks for the comment, Dave. Let's go to Jeff in Evansville. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Great. Thanks for the call.
So I've been marching around outside, and I located my stinging nettle. I've got a little thing that I do in my greenhouse where I spread my compost in December and then put the covers on my cold frames in there and water them real good. And I've been eating lamb's quarters for about almost a month now. So tonight I'm going to make a lamb's quarters and stinging nettle sag paneer. I've also got some mustards that got away from me that I'm going to go through and clip too. And I'll tell you what, it is delicious.
That sounds great, and I'm excited for you. I'm actually coming to southern Wisconsin today, and I'm hoping I can get some greens ahead of what we have up north and bring them home and make some big green-based dishes. And I love what you said. Is it Jeff?
Yes.
The caller, in that you know, people often think of like foraging and gardening as if they're opposed. And that's really kind of a strange new idea. I mean, historically, all over the world, almost every society, there were people gardened and people farmed, small-scale farming. People combine foraging and gardening, and they get the best of both worlds. You know, you don't forage out of an emergency because you're starving. I mean, you could, but most foraging that takes place is because it gives people the best combination of food, and it increases the diversity of what you can eat. And you know, we think of foraging sometimes as like emergency food, but it's also gourmet food. I mean, maple syrup, ramps, these are things that you'd pay a lot of money for if you bought. You get to have the best food in the world for free if you have a little bit of knowledge by both gardening and foraging.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. Enjoy your meal this evening. That brings me to one question that we may want to talk about, in that if you're foraging in your backyard or, you know, near where people might be treating lawns, you have to be pretty careful, don't you?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I'm kind of excited, and I would have just talked about all the plants I'm excited about and forgot this basic detail. People often think of misidentifying plants as like the biggest fear of foraging, but people have really good common sense and very rarely eat something they haven't identified well. I mean, those kind of poisons are exceptionally rare. But the bigger fear that I tell beginning foragers about, and that I certainly worry about more myself, is making sure that you are not eating plants sprayed with herbicide. And one of the hardest parts about this is that our cultural relationship to herbicide is changing. We use it way more now than we did 30 years ago. And 70 years ago, it was hardly being used. And so we don't have a good set of cultural norms around herbicide use, or and I can't give you a rule for foraging to how you know something hasn't been sprayed with herbicide, except know the spot you forage from. I'm lucky that I forage on my own land, or I have, you know, neighbors. But in the national forest, for example, if you're going to go pick blueberries, and if they're going to spray herbicide in an area, you know, where there might be blueberry pickers, they're generally going to post that. And but we're having some faith here that it hasn't been sprayed without being posted. So that's my biggest fear. I wish I could tell your listeners there's this one rule. But you need to just use common sense in assessing where people may or may not have sprayed. And when in doubt, don't eat or ask, you know, someone.
Sure. We're talking with Sam Thayer, an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about foraging. Sam, we did have a call from Bob who couldn't stay with us, and he says that he knows that you love wild plums, and he wants to know when is the best time to harvest them.
Okay, well, we have two species of native wild plum in Wisconsin. We have the American plum and the Canada plum. They're both statewide, but the Canada plum is much more common in the north. And the Canada plum, now, I'm just going to just say, imagine Wausau or the center of the state for these times I'm giving. And then if you're in the far north, you're going to add a week and a half to that. If you're in the far south, you're going to subtract a week and a half. But the Canada plum, say at Wausau latitude, is going to ripen generally about August 15th to 20th. And the season is not, you know, it's fairly long, but it's not a long season like apple season. There's about a 2 week period. And then the American plum, the peak ripening is about September 1st, maybe August 25th, a little bit later. The American plum has a thicker skin and very juicy inside. The Canadian plum has a thin skin and a pulpier inside, but they both make delicious jams and jellies, and we do canned plums. I take my lightest maple syrup, and then I mix it 50-50 with water, and then I use that as like the liquid. You know, I pour over in between the plums, so I water bath can wild plums that way. Then I let it sit for like 6 months, and we pull these canned plums out, and we eat them like as a dessert, but then we save that liquid, and we use it to flavor fizzy water, and it's this beautiful, pink, delicious plum fizzy water. So in our house, it's a regular thing. You know, once a week or more, we'll say, hey, let's open a plum fizzy at dinner tonight. I love them that way. They make good fruit leather. Mm. But the plum pulp itself is sour enough that as straight-up fruit leather, it's a little too strong. So we mix it at like one-quarter plum or one-third plum, and then the rest applesauce to make fruit leather, great fruit leather. But the best thing is at plum season, peak season, when they're totally ripe, where you just touch them and they fall off, or if you accidentally bump a bush, there's like 35 fall on the ground right away. They're just so juicy inside. And, you know, we call it sucking plum nectar. We'll just go out to our fence line where we have some great wild plums, and we'll just bite it and suck the juice out. And you know what? Just toss that seed. The flying squirrels eat the seeds. The mice eat the seeds. And we'll just gorge on plums until we're sick of them. So it's just a great wild edible.
I love it. Oh, I'm going to be looking for one of those because that sounds delicious.
And you know, they're found statewide. And almost every city has plum thickets in the city, in a park. You know, along road shoulders. I mean, you find them anywhere statewide.
How big does the fruit get?
Oh, well, that's a great question. So they're quite variable. And if you find one wild plum doesn't taste good to you and you know it's ripe, try another. They're like apples. They're highly variable. The best ones are like an inch and a half, inch and three quarters in diameter. Actually, I'm in Eau Claire right now, and there's one near Eau Claire, east of town. I'm not going to say exactly where, a few miles. There's this along the road, there's this plum patch. Oh, they're just giant, and they're delicious. The bigger ones are like a typical domestic plum, but some of them are as small as like, you know, 5/8 of an inch, but I ignore those small ones. The average one's about an inch diameter.
Okay. Yeah, they're pretty small. Good to know.
They're pretty small, but boy, they're loaded, they are loaded. I mean, you can fill a 5-gallon bucket in a matter of 10 minutes when they're loaded.
Nice. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a few more people waiting here. Rachel in Whitewater, go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you for answering all of our questions. You were talking about creeping Charlie and daylilies, and creeping Charlie doesn't taste good. Stay away from daylilies if you're new to foraging. What would you recommend as some plant to eat to get used to the different taste profile when foraging, so it doesn't turn people away and you can kind of build up that acquired taste?
Sure. Well, I would say that each plant is its own acquired skill and its own acquired taste. So I'm not saying beginners should stay away from daylily. I'm saying anybody with whom it disagrees should stay away. And so think of foraging not as a skill you learn. Think of it as like this kind of umbrella term, and each individual plant is its own skill. Because I could name most people wild edible plants that they already like, say red raspberry, black cap raspberries. You know, most people know those and like them, wild blueberries. And so just that idea helps people get over the idea that wild foods have strong or aversive flavors. Every flavor is kind of scary to people when it's brand new, no matter what it is. But so some of the most mildly flavored plants, like I call them gateway wild edibles. One of them that I like to recommend for people is thistle stalks. The hard part about a thistle stalk is that people tend to get them too late in the season when they're very young. There's something magical that happens when you take this plant that's essentially a weapon, and then you turn it into a vegetable. And now somebody like my brother that just doesn't like vegetables is not going to be really into a thistle stalk. But most people that like vegetables, I mean, you peel a thistle stalk at the right time, I don't care how you cook it, like, you know, people are going to like it. It's just incredibly mild and easy to eat. There's nothing objectionable about it. So when I do beginner workshops with foraging, and it's the time of year when I can peel a thistle and share it with people, that's like my go-to thing. I'm like, just wait till you see this. The world is going to seem magical. We mentioned earlier chickweed. That's a great one. It's mild. Another one coming up soon is basswood leaves. Right after the buds open, basswoods are so common, and it's just such a mild leafy green. And then again, like I mentioned, all these different wild berries, you know, there's the very well-known ones. There's some that are less well-known. But, you know, you make something good with wild berries, and people are not going to find that objectionable. So there's a lot of good gateway plants. You don't have to focus on these strong-flavored plants. But give those strong flavored plants a few shots. You know, there's people grow up, kids don't like beer the first few times they taste it. And then a lot of people grow up to like beer. Strong flavors take a longer time for people to grow to like them, but then they often grow to very much like strong flavors, like chocolate, all sorts of different strong things. So there's both kind of wild plants.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rachel. Appreciate that question. Let's go to Cater in Herbster. Go ahead, Cater.
Hey, Sam.
Hey, Cater.
I missed the first part of your talk because I was out roaming around, so you may have covered this, but just wondered if you're seeing anything drastic happening to the health of plant populations or phenologies due to climate change?
You know, I would say not. I would say that there are years who have been exceptionally early, a few exceptionally late years also recently. But one thing that I try to keep in mind is the plants have been here a long time through climate changes that weren't necessarily as volatile as what we're seeing now, but really great differences in climate. And most of them have broad ranges. And what was fascinating about last winter being incredibly mild was to watch how the plants reacted to a mild winter. We're used to ramps, for example, emerging as soon as the ground thaws or the snow melts. But last year, when the ground didn't freeze and there was no snow in most of the state, the ramps just waited. So interesting to see them behave that way, how they might behave like Kentucky in a much warmer climate. So it seems that they have the inherent ability to handle these fluctuations. But overall, I would say it doesn't seem to have a dramatic negative impact on the plants in general. But certainly like last winter, not this most recent one, but the one before, that was amazing to watch because none of us in northern Wisconsin have ever seen a winter that mild. And certainly the plants, they had to fall back on their ancient adaptations to handle totally different weather, you know, abnormal weather.
Okay, thank you so much, Cater. I appreciate that call. Now, in the last 3 minutes or so that we have, I know we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the restrictions and things that are happening. Now, Nicole Inshano emailed us, and she's wondering about these things, too. As more people go out and forage, how is this going to affect, you know, nature, plants, animals, et cetera? And is there a worry that public lands will be destroyed? So what's going on with Minnesota, because they've been doing some things, haven't they?
Well, Minnesota has some proposed legislation for foraging regulations on state land, and I've been in contact with the people on the foraging side of that issue regularly, and it appears those regulations are probably not going to pass. I feel like this is something that societally we need to deal with. So foraging has not been highly regulated except for the things for which there's a lot of pressure, right? And so the two things that you need a license to forage in Wisconsin are ginseng and wild rice. And I am fully in support of all necessary conservation measures and beyond what most people are thinking, not just conservation, but how do we take care of all these plants? And I think we need more people foraging so that we have people paying attention to the plants, and it's the foragers who speak up for the plants. It was wild rice harvesters that, you know, protected wild rice when it was intentionally being systematically eliminated from most of the lakes in the state 70 years ago. And it was wild rice harvesters who stopped that from happening. And so I think we need people foraging to be the eyes and the ears for the plants that we care about, because when you eat something, you experience gratitude, and you really become the protector, the caretaker. That being said, there's always irresponsible people out there, and we need a way to deal with that. And I would advise against over-regulation, regulations that don't need to exist. And I'll say, for example, I hunt snowshoe hares. For snowshoe hare hunting in Wisconsin, there's no limit in the number that you can shoot, and there's no limit to the season. And that's because it's an abundant animal in comparison to the number of people who want to harvest it. And that's the case with most of our wild edibles. You know, nettles are not under pressure, you know, of being eliminated.
No.
Ramps are not under pressure of being eliminated, even though some people are making that claim. They are becoming more abundant, not less abundant, over the last decades. And so I think we need to pinpoint the things that need protection and not create unnecessary regulation. And that's how we manage our wildlife and our fish. And that's how we should manage our plants also. But I do think the conversation needs to happen, and foragers need to take an active part in that, so that it's not regulated by people that have no stake in it, which is kind of what almost happened in Minnesota. It's a very interesting process here. And I think those of us who forage need to really ask ourselves, what do we want and what do we need, and become involved in the process of creating those regulations. I think we have very reasonable regulations in our state parks and forests. For example, Wisconsin, we can collect berries, fruits, nuts, mushrooms for personal consumption. I don't think there's any reason people should be commercially harvesting anything on public lands. Not that it necessarily shouldn't ever happen either, but I'm comfortable with that. In our national forests, my family picks blueberries and service berries every year in the national forest, a lot that we eat, and it's not under heavy pressure. I mean, last year we had a spot, there was a mile, there was tons of blueberries.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, we love your enthusiasm, Sam. It's catching. So thank you so much for being back with us again. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet. So Sam Thayer is our guest today. If you want to find out more about his books, he's got a DVD, he teaches classes, go to foragersharvest.com.